Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Welcome to the new reality edition of Bite Marks Cafe right here on Hawaii Public Radio, where we serve you the first bite of today's science, technology, and innovation. I'm Bert Lum. And on today's show, we're going to catch up with Brian Glazer. He's an associate professor in oceanography over at the University of Hawaii and the co-founder and CEO of Hohonu Inc. And Brian, I want to welcome you back to Bite Marks Cafe. It's been a while.
Thanks so much, Bert. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and you can probably recollect, we had you on probably a couple of times, but the most recent one was when you folks had a pretty big contract, I think, with NOAA. And maybe what you can do for the benefit of folks that are new to Hohonu, you know, what is it that you do, and then how did you kind of go from, you know, putting sensors into you know, Paepae Ohe'ia, and growing from that into kind of, you know, a lot of sensor work across the country. So tell us, you know, a little bit about that sort of startup story.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this might be my fourth time on the show. It's been so much fun every time. I'm an oceanography professor at UH, and I tell people all the time, I'm not an engineer, I'm not a programmer, but I can dabble, and I've always applied kinds of ways to think about sensors and instrumentation and ocean observing tools in the kinds of like the research that I like to do. Mm-hmm. Some of that was deep sea research that, you know, $1 million project and 10 people in the world maybe read the paper, and others were maybe a little bit more applicable and broadly applicable. And so going on about 12 years ago, we had a little bit of funding from NOAA Sea Grant, and that's what really kicked off this idea that we could apply lower cost technologies to the oceans, to climate, to climate threats in places like Hei'ia Fish Pond and other fish ponds. And we realized that there was a demand for that outside of academia, outside of Hawaii. And the university was encouraging us to think about commercialization pathways. And that's what launched Hohonu, quite mm-hmm, frankly. Mm-hmm. We launched in 2019, and our first contract was with a division of NOAA, the Integrated Ocean Observing System in the Southeast. So Hohonu's first customers were 5,000 miles away from Hawaii, having problems about episodic flooding events in the coast, and the nearest NOAA tide gauge just wasn't close enough. And so, you know, fast forwarding to today, we did that well enough to kind of grow through word of mouth. Today, we're operating in 18 states and over 200 locations.
No, and that's pretty impressive. I remember the first time you and I chatted was really when you were primarily, you know, your full-time function was a professor. But it was interesting to me that you had this sensor technology and was able to, you know, get out into places like, you know, the fish pond at Hei'ia and actually kind of tell the story through data about various kind of climate impacts. And I thought, oh, that's pretty interesting. And then I think that's when you were telling me that Hohonu was you know, kind of starting to form, or maybe the idea of commercialization was starting entering into your mind, right? And of course, I remember having this conversation about how you as a professor had to kind of start thinking, you know, what do I do? Do I, you know, continue to be a professor, or do I go this path of commercialization and starting a business? And, you know, either one of those is a full-time job. So, you know, how did you kind of wrestle with the idea that, oh man, at that time the first love was, you know, being a professor, and then all of a sudden this draw upon your, you know, wanting to start a business, commercialize, you know, and go the sort of the startup route, you know, you must have had to really kind of make a decision, and to today, right, you still are sort of thinking, you know, which path is that going to be in terms of long term?
Absolutely right. It's been a fun challenge. And at the same time, a lot of the kinds of things that we were doing in the research lab were applicable mm-hmm. to solving real world problems, and they weren't research anymore. They were really operational and applied. And after that initial seed funding from NOAA Sea Grant we had in the lab, then I had funding from the National Science Foundation. And the title of that grant was literally Democratizing Access to Ocean Observing Technology. Now, it's a little bit of a mouthful, but what it really means is for places or people who previously didn't have the kind of funding or expertise available to solve these coastal problems, something has changed. We have, you know, lower costs for components that came out of Silicon Valley in the smartphone industry, and they hadn't quite yet been applied to the kind of, you know, environmental science projects that we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And what I realized and made the decision to launch Hohonu was that we could do that better with Hohonu than I could ever dream of doing, keeping it in the lab, having, you know, students really build things, and keeping it research funded. And mm-hmm. so really the demand exceeded the capacity that we had to keep it as a lab funded thing. Mm-hmm. And that's why we went with Hohonu.
Now, as a lab funded thing, I mean, you can, like you said, go after NSF grants and you can keep the lab going. But as you start to enter into the whole world of a startup, what are some of the challenges that you face, you know, from a funding model? And what you described to me sounds like a need. Are there commercial funders, you know, in the form of venture capital and others that want to see a business like this, you know, grow and succeed? And I know, you know, there was some good relationships with Purple Maya and others. How did that inform where you're headed now from a startup standpoint? And, you know, are there venture funds that are willing to put money into companies like Hohonu?
Yeah, great question. And so, you know, UH took a chance on us. They mm-hmm. they gave us a little bit of seed funding to launch the company and get started, move outside of the walls of the lab. And so there's a clear conflict of interest management there between what happens at Hohonu off campus and what happened in my lab. It's mm-hmm. a research entity. But also there's this entire other ecosystem. So my co-founders and I had deep expertise and domain knowledge in coastal oceanography and flooding and thinking about data science, but we didn't know how to start a startup. And some of that is formulaic, but you need mentors. And then you need a business plan that is equally matching that experience and credibility from the research space. Mm-hmm. And Purple Maya was absolutely instrumental for us. To this very day, Donovan Kehaloa is the chair of Hohonu's board. We rely on him all the time mm-hmm. for advice. So he has an active role in helping to mentor us through this day. And through programs like Purple Maya, Elemental Impact, and other accelerator programs, we've been able to kind of meet these networks, and we've raised a pre-seed round and a seed round of venture funding as well.
And I guess, do you find yourself, I guess, from going from a researcher and a somebody that runs a lab, has students involved, and the technology, to somebody that now probably spends more time than they want to fundraising?
Yeah, so that's also a great question, right? You know, my love is the science and the domain knowledge of it and the kind of the challenges of new locations and how we go forward there, as opposed to kind of like running a business. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in addition to the, you know, finding groups to take a risk on an idea, a startup, and helping to mentor them, the personal and professional networks that develop out of that are equally important. And so, you know, our chief of operations, Kevin Mukai, again, we wouldn't be where we are today without him specifically, but folks like that. There's introductions for people who can help run a business equally to, should this be a business at all, especially in a domain like this, which is a little bit different than other kinds of things, trying to pitch data as a service.
Now, you mentioned, you know, should this be a business? And I think you said Kevin is probably very much involved with that and advising the direction that Hohonu takes. I'd like you to share a little bit more about that, especially from what you just said about having that contract that expanded your presence into 18 states. How do you see that expansion, and how do you see sort of the operational scaling of what Hohonu does, you know, as we move from 2026 and beyond? So what we'll do is we'll hold that thought. We'll be right back after this short break to continue our conversation with Brian Glazer, co-founder and CEO of Hohonu. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to Ulupono Initiative.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe right here on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR1. I'm Bert Lum, And if you're just joining us, we're catching up with Brian Glazer. He's associate professor over at the University of Hawaii in oceanography, and as well as the co-founder and CEO of Hohonu. And of course, right before the break, Brian, you know, you were talking about the, you know, the startup world, the business of Hohonu, the fact that, you know, you're probably more involved with fundraising now than the research part. And you also mentioned the fact that, you know, one of the, I think, pivotal projects that you folks embarked on was the funding from NOAA that expanded your presence into 18 states. Does that, you know, that did that provide you an indication that there is a potential out there? And how do you see taking advantage of that potential and perhaps, you know, moving from the seed funding to a Series A funding?
Yeah, great questions. And so, you know, again, at the time, I was a full-time professor and a part-time CEO. Mm-hmm. And that works for the domain knowledge side of it, but it doesn't work for day-to-day operations or hiring folks and really building a team around it. I needed help with that. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, where, you know, Purple Mile Network introduced me to Kevin Mukai. He's been working with us now for 6 years as our full-time chief operations officer. And without him, the day-to-day of running, starting up and ramping up Hohonu early operations never would have happened. And so, you know, we really give him credit for that. And it's a problem in, you know, there's a lot of great ideas that can incubate in university systems, but they sit on a shelf because they don't have the Kevins. And so I would argue that in order to get beyond startups, there's that second valley of death, and, you know, finding those business-minded Kevins out there, mm-hmm. is something that helps to accelerate equally. For us, as, you know, as you mentioned, our first bits of revenue were still federally funded, mm-hmm. and matching what we knew about domain knowledge and in the space on the business side to give us a business credibility as an operational company selling data as a service, you know, that comes from equally minded people who are capable at running startups. And so that allowed us to show and demonstrate what we were capable of with federal funding across a region from North Carolina to Florida with maybe about 40 sensors. And then all of a sudden, we really saw people start to take an appreciation for what we specifically could do, both from the research side, providing data, and the business operations side, to today, where most of our largest customers aren't federally funded. They're local, municipality, or state-funded emergency management, public works, or departments of transportation.
Now, that's an important sort of shift, right? Because federally funding, and now if you're getting local funding, you're much closer to the ground. You guys are, Hohonu is locally based. How are you getting exposure to some of these local counties, local municipalities, these disaster preparedness organizations?
Yeah, this is a great question. I love this one. Our co-founders have been around for 30 years in coastal oceanography, so we had a great professional network that we could lean into and engage with, mm-hmm. go out and do seminars and really connect. The other side of it was that we knew that we wanted to connect at the local. You know, there's a saying that, you know, all disasters are local until they're not. And that resonates with emergency management for a very good reason. And we also didn't want to pretend, like sitting in Hawaii, that we could tell an emergency manager in Folly Beach, South Carolina, where to put a sensor without mm-hmm. listening to them and mm-hmm. looking at it and coming up with an experimental design that fit. And so that idea of both engaging with professional academic networks, but also reaching out to national level nonprofits with local chapters, gave us a kind of a flywheel of acceleration into these regions through trusted endorsements, you know, unofficial endorsements by being invited to be a panelist on a webinar, for example, and, work with local weather forecasting offices of National Weather Service. And so those conversations act as credibility flywheels for those local level connections.
Did you find yourself having to be present in all of those locations in some form or fashion in order to build that level of credibility and trust?
Yes. And so this was a neat transition where, again, I was full-time professor and part-time CEO up until about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And the balance just, it was too much. And I was starting to drop balls and didn't feel good about that on both sides of the fence. Mm-hmm. And so I'm currently on 100% leave of absence from the university. I still have my office and my labs and one project, but I'm a full-time CEO now. And exactly what you said. You hit the nail on the head. There is that demand for in-person relationship building and trust building with emergency management, with public works at that local level. In 2025, I had 13 trips to Florida in person.
That's like more than once a month.
Yes.
And that's just one location. That's just one location.
And that was just Florida. So, you know, regionally, we can do that and show up. And, you know, it sets the tone that this is a company that's based out of Hawaii. We have a 12-employee group now with us, and most of us are based here in Hawaii. We build the sensors right up at Manoa Innovation Center. Mm-hmm. So we are still very Hawaii-grounded and rooted. But those personal relationships and getting out and showing and demonstrating that you do care about what's happening at the local level elsewhere has, I think, been part of our success in growing.
Has there been any sort of pull upon Hohonu to locate somewhere else or have offices elsewhere? I mean, you've been successful at pretty much keeping everybody here, right? But is there some kind of startup pull that starts to happen because of investors or because of, you know, maybe the nexus of where some of the work seems to be happening?
Yeah, and some of the new developments and the rate at which we're seeing adoption spread regionally are starting to pull us in that direction. We want to be here in Hawaii. You know, our group is located here. As I mentioned, mm-hmm. we have the Kua Foundation is also a partial equity owner in this company because we wanted to ingrain in the DNA of the company. Yes, it's a for-profit Delaware C corporation, but we're also mission-driven. Mm-hmm. And so the university remains a partial equity owner today. We want to keep that Hawaiian grounding rooted in the company. That said, as we grow networks, there could be a day where, you know, contracting friends and environmental consulting firms on the East Coast to do installations or maintenance on hardware deployments, for example, dictates that Hohonu needs an office in Florida, in Texas, in Massachusetts, something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I took a look at the website and was quite impressed with, you know, the dashboard and how extensive it is. And I would advise anybody interested in, you know, sensor technology and the work that Hohonu does to go and check out the dashboard. And maybe, you know, you can start talking about the technologies that you're incorporating into the sort of like the new and improved Hohonu. And one of the things that I don't think we talked about the last time I had you on was this idea of real-time flood intelligence and what that might look like. So maybe start with a dashboard. I mean, just to get people to take a look at it, what is it that is reflective of Hohonu on as a result of this dashboard?
Yeah, this is a fun question too. It does start with the hardware, right? We have a hardware component, but we're also today ingesting NOAA's data. We're ingesting USGS data. We're ingesting other credible data sources for water level. And there, you know, the federal government does a great job with the funding that it has and resources available. And it's not always the most efficient at delivering that data in an accessible format to the general public. And mm-hmm. So, you know, when events happen and when flooding events happen, it's not necessarily a surprise that we hear complaints from the public that we don't know how to access data. We didn't know that the rate of change of this stream or this king tide event were going to be that bad. And, you know, a lot of that falls outside of the federal government's mission, say USGS or NOAA. Mm-hmm. And so what we did was we knew that we wanted to add a densification, add new sensors in new locations. That's a hardware component, but that wasn't enough. We also knew that we wanted to make that data digestible and accessible to non-experts, non-scientists. And so we really looked at all the dashboards that were out there, all the different delivery mechanisms for data, and we wanted it all to be publicly available and simple enough to use that non-experts could do it. So today, anybody publicly, freely can go to dashboard.hohonu.io and look at. We ingest all of NOAA's data, so all of the tide gauge data that that NOAA produces is there, as well as certain select USGS sites. We added USGS sites here in Hawaii. We'll probably talk about that in the next segment. Mm-hmm. We also added USGS sites in Florida at their request, and other water management district sensors, that kind of thing that we can add in. And then we supplement that with Hohonu sensors that we've deployed. And again, this is all free for anybody to access. Click, you know, take a look at it. You can see 30 days of data with no problem, as well as some of our proprietary forecasting too. So we really wanted it to be easy to use. If you have a favorite station that's most important to you, one click and you can sign up for text message alerts for when we're predicting that that threshold will be crossed at that location, as well as when it actually crosses as well. So really, we put a lot of thought into the UI and how to deliver that data to anybody, anywhere.
Now, you know, one of the things that I sort of thought when, you know, you talk about real-time sort of flood intelligence, and in the context of what happened recently in Hawaii with the Kona Lows, and the Kona Lows sort of introduced this really sort of almost like a random variable that had huge flood impacts to areas that you typically don't hear about, you know, getting flooded. And I'm really curious to hear, you know, sort of Hohonu's approach to that and how perhaps sensors and technology could help better predict those kinds of occurrences. Well, so we'll hold that thought. We'll be right back at a short break to continue our conversation with Brian Glazer, co-founder and CEO of Hohonu. This is Bite Marks Cafe. Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum right here on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR1. And if you're just joining us, we're talking to Brian Glazer, associate professor over at the University of Hawaii in the Oceanography Department, and of course, co-founder and CEO of Hohonu Inc. And right before the break, Brian, you know, there's this idea of areas that get flooded and sensors being able to better predict, you know, what the situation might be given a certain, you know, set of factors, right? Now that we've, you know, sort of experienced these Kona Lows, and there were like multiple Kona Lows, and they all impacted kind of different areas, but areas that we normally don't think of getting flooded. What is Hohonu's approach to sort of using whatever technology, AI, predictive, to better assess the potential for flooding in areas like this?
It's a somber question, right? I want to start off with kind of the coastal zone, because I'm an oceanography professor, mm-hmm, and I'll show you what we're doing today. We've made progress in anticipating that we need to reduce uncertainty in making predictions. And, you know, I kind of mentioned earlier about king tide events. And so we heard from communities in South Carolina, hey, we can't pick up our kids from preschool during high tide flooding events. These king tides never used to flood these roads, mm-hmm, before. Mm-hmm. We need help. And so our approach initially was to put new sensors in new locations. Adding that density of sensors allows us to see what happens in real time. Mm-hmm. And then the longer they're in place, the better they become at making those predictions. And again, we came at this from a place of coastal oceanography. We're at a point today where we're 51% better than traditional methods for predicting where and when king tides will happen and how bad they'll be, to the point where if the federal government puts out an alert saying, oh, 10% chance of moderate flooding during the next king tide event for this coastline, we can come in and say, well, it's more like a 97% chance of a foot and a half flooding at this location, this mm-hmm. intersection. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, that combination of the right sensor in the right place, but also accelerating our back end and our modeling, our output of forecasting using machine learning and using artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So when we tie that over to things like the Kona Low or the Texas floods that we saw last July or mm-hmm. even last week, it's harder for me as an oceanographer. It's also hard, right? National Weather Service does a great job of forecasting and putting out alerts. But as we see more frequent and more intense flash flooding coming from rain, these kinds of flooding events become more frequent as well. And so, again, we're looking at this parallel as we're in a position to do inland on rivers, on lakes, on streams, on reservoirs, what we've done successfully in the coastal zone by having a piece of hardware that's robust, reliable, and easy and cost-effective to deploy everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then once, you know, I'm going to let NWS and meteorologists predict the rain. Once it's not rain anymore, I'll be able to, you know, Hohonu will be able to tell you, right, which tributaries are rising faster. Do we need to go and do maintenance on this one? What are the ramifications for bridge scouring? Those kinds of things mm-hmm. is what we're working on with our kind of artificial intelligence platform.
Yeah, no, you make a great point because, you know, if it's a king tide, those are somewhat predictable, right? Because it's based on the tidal fluctuations. But when you start talking about Kona Lows and how they are pretty unpredictable in, or at least I guess the period of time between when you see the potential of a Kona Loa and the actual dropping of rain is a very short window. And to understand the impact of that incredible amount of water, you know, in a relatively, you know, small, comparatively to the, let's say, the entire island of Oahu or even Maui as an example, it's harder to really kind of predict and then prepare for that kind of very isolated examples of a Kona Loa type of flooding. I mean, the response I would expect from you is that, you know, those are really hard to predict.
They are. And you know, the operational questions of how often do roads flood and how deep does the flooding get and how long does it last, and what we saw in Manoa, right? There is a USGS stream gauge right there in Manoa, right around the corner from the Manoa Innovation Center.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave useful information, but not enough. And the reality is that there were over 150 public flood reports across those two storm weekends that we saw here in Hawaii. More than 60% of them were more than a mile away from a publicly available gauge that existed.
Mm.
You know, 2 miles was the average distance from a reported flooding event to the nearest publicly available gauge. So again, fundamental to Hohonu's thesis of densification of sensors. More sensors in more locations gives us redundancy and information about how water is behaving once it's not rain anymore is kind of our thesis of how we can help for these kinds of events going forward.
And so with access to more of that data, that's where you can apply sort of predictive tools and AI to better understand, you know, the patterns.
Exactly. The predictions help with forecasting and thinking about getting ready, and the real-time information of having new sensors in new locations is operational. And so emergency operations centers might be able to do things like road closures 45 minutes or 50 minutes sooner than they would have without those sensors in locations.
And so, you know, going forward, and even before when we first started, you know, talking on the radio, was AI, you know, a part of your solution set? I'm imagining that it is much more nowadays than it is, you know, when you first started.
It is nowadays. And at the same time, it's not going to solve everything. And, you know, AI, the most sophisticated AI models today need better granular data because of the disturbances and the variability that we're seeing and the impact from those kinds of events. So we're working with some of the world's best at artificial intelligence forecasting for both fluvial and compound flooding.
Mm-hmm.
And we're playing our own role.
No, and you know, you mentioned the USGS and pushing for those data sets to be available. Is that helpful?
Absolutely. Yeah, more data and making it easily accessible by the public and digestible so that anybody can access these data and look at it and understand how and when to act is all part of the outcome.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And of course, Hohonu is probably one of the key companies that are using this data in a very useful manner. So I applaud you and you know, success in your, you know, your next endeavors. Where can people find out more information about Hohonu?
Hohonu.io. That's Hohonu.io.
Very good. Brian Glazer, Associate Professor at the University of Hawaii in Oceanography, and of course, co-founder and CEO of Hohonu Inc. Hey, Brian, I want to thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
And of course, thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we'll be joined by rapper Illmatic. If you miss any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. Our engineer is David Chong. You can catch us on HPR One every Friday or anytime via the HPR app or your favorite podcast application. In the meantime, you stay safe, you stay awesome. We'll see you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.